Okay. So hello and welcome to a special Daily Remedy episode podcast. We have here today a Dr. William Cook, the author of Canary in a Coal Mine, A Forgotten Rural Community, A Hidden Epidemic, and A Lone Doctor Battling for the Life, Health, and Soul of the People. It is the story of one doctor's courageous fight to save a small town from a silent epidemic that threatened the community's future and exposed a national health crisis. So welcome, Dr. Cook. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to join you and to be a part of this.
Well, I appreciate that. So, you know, before we kind of jump into a lot of the analysis and the insight that you provide, I wanted to kind of piggyback off of what we were discussing a little bit before we started and kind of get your thoughts on how this book came about. And many doctors, they have many stories, as each patient is a story, but few are as compelling as the direct patient experiences that you essentially brought to life through your words. Why did you decide on this memoir format? And how did you go from some of the more technical writing to the more narrative-based writing that the book has?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question and things that I wrestled with as I was considering the book, because it very well could have been written in a very technical way to just address the diseases. But what I really wanted to do was personalize the people behind the diseases, and it was my belief from working in that community for, you know, a couple of decades now, that we have focused so heavily on diseases in America that we've gotten very good at keeping sick people alive, but our life expectancy is falling. We're near the last, you know, in the world in life expectancy. So somehow, although we do a good job of keeping sick people alive, we don't do a very good job of just keeping people alive. And so what I realized is writing it in a technical way to address diseases was really just buying into that broken system. And I wanted to get underneath of that and really to reveal the humanity of the people suffering from those diseases and what caused those diseases in the first place. They're late manifestations of something else that had been going on their whole life. And so I wanted to get at that and really personalize it, show the stories of people who didn't choose to be born and raised in a community with a life expectancy 15 years lower than the life expectancy in other counties very close by.
And inherent in what you're saying and what really appears multiple points in your book is there's a dichotomy between the patient and the person and the life a person lives and the health experience a patient goes through. You mentioned you experienced quite a bit of education throughout your medical training, but you clearly denoted this multiple times. Nothing could prepare you for the experience of Austin, Indiana. So talk to us a little bit about this dichotomy that you elucidate so beautifully, the patient and the person, the medical treatment and the life lived.
Yeah, so, I mean, for one, you know, growing up in a poor family and seeing the struggles that my family members were bumping up against and seeing some of us be able to rise above that and believing that the American dream was possible for everyone. That was one of my thoughts is going to a poor community like Austin is to be able to help people overcome poverty and toxic stress and substance use disorder like my family had overcome. And so I expected that to be possible, but then one of the things that was unexpected to me was how incredibly daunting the circumstances are for certain people. And, you know, working with a patient within the exam room, you know, we're faced with certain numbers, with certain demographic information, and we have responses to those based on statistics. But those statistics break down when you're actually dealing with a person. And really stopping and setting all of that aside and listening to the story of the person sitting in the exam room it paints a different picture sometimes. And sometimes, you know, people, again, you know, being born into circumstances beyond their control and growing up within that system, the circumstances working against them can seem so overwhelming that oftentimes they give up and they stop trying. And trying to figure out how to rekindle that motivation and help them find resources to lower that gradient. I think of this this graphic that I put in some of my slides. It's a person pushing their health risks up a gradient, and that gradient is increased by things like poverty, lack of transportation, unemployment, education, generational trauma. And the more things underneath of that, the steeper that hill gets until that boulder that they're pushing up against that gradient is so heavy, it just rolls back over them. And they might've been trying really, really hard to push that health risk up that hill. They might be trying harder than a lot of others. They don't appear to be in the exam room. They don't appear to be because They've got all of these diseases that have mounted up because of all of the circumstances that they're battling against. So I think when we don't stop to hear the person, the stories behind the person, we're never really able to help the patient the way that we should be able to.
I'm really glad you phrased it that way, using the analogy of a gradient. And I want to explore that a little bit further, because one of the things I like to say is that there's the data and then there's a perception of the data. It's the story of the person who lives the health conditions, who lives through diseases that you're alluding to, becomes more impactful long-term in their overall chronic care, whether that's something like a diabetes or something like a diabetes now complicated by a substance use dependency due to the lifestyle conditions. Let's explore this gradient analogy a little bit more, because I it kind of aligns with how you phrased a lot of the context around the stories. When a patient comes to you, you don't immediately see that gradient. It's something that forms over time, and typically through conversations that you have with the patient about anything and everything outside of the healthcare experience. So it's that bond that then forms. So for you in writing this book, you clearly have that emotional empathy that's needed. How did that develop over time? And when did this concept of a gradient being really something that's extra medical come to your whole mindset and practicing?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's not really like a moment I can mm-hmm. really put my finger on, like a light switch that went off. There was a lot of things that kind of played into that. One was just getting to know Austin and the community and what people were dealing with. There's a historic context that people are raised within, and I don't think we really truly understand our patients until we take the time to understand the historic context of their lives. You know, you're dealing oftentimes with generational issues. You know, in urban settings, you know, Black and Brown people, we know have experienced a lot of trauma and injustice, and that person being born into that, they carry the weight of history into their life already. Mm-hmm. In the rural setting that I practice, you know, poor white people, deindustrialization has led to you know, unemployment and jobs going away and industry going away, and that generational toxic stress, you know, that people are born into, they're already carrying the weight of history into their life. And so I think part of it's just understanding the historic context that people are born into to really understand their life in a greater context. I think I got off track there. So you want to reframe the question for me? I can go back into it.
not at all. Don't even worry about it. I like how you phrased the historical context. So we were talking about the gradient component. And what I right. think you're mentioning is that there is a historic component to these mental gradients that patients feel. Mm-hmm. And in your book, you talk about HIV, and then you talk about opioids. And then you start to kind of tease out how, you know, the pandemic really brought out a lot of these things that were already present. And That historical context, as you mentioned too, current problems that began in the 1980s really kind of show their root when they're stress test, if you will, the gradient starts to shift. What I think is really interesting about how you contextualize these social problems in this manner is that we don't see this every day. We talk about social determinants of health, and we try to kind of, you know, use corporate speak to talk about these issues, but they're anything but corporate, as you alluded to. And when you look at these issues as they're presenting themselves in the mainstream media, in the kind of corporate speak of corporatized America, what are they missing? What are you able to see that they're not able to see?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, oftentimes we're responding to what we see during a disaster.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that I mentioned in the book is diseases and disasters don't create these cultural phenomena, these injustices, they reveal them. And they've been going on for a long time. And sometimes when we react to these disasters, like a hurricane or a pandemic, and we notice the disparities that are occurring within the community, we're not really honoring all that came before that. Yeah. And it's kind of disrespectful to take notice then without mentioning all of the historic context that led up to that moment. It wasn't the disease of COVID-19 that's caused the health disparities in America, but we're noticing it now. It's not the hurricane that causes the trauma of different, you know, people groups. It's the historic context of that. And I think we're disrespecting people and not honoring that when we just take notice during those moments. And we're never going to stop that disparity that occurs during those crisis moments unless we're willing to dig a little bit deeper, hear stories, learn from people with lived experiences, and dig in there and try to figure out what those root causes of the health disparities are. We can't accept that America is one of the worst places to live in the in the world, because we die sooner. Yeah. That can't be okay. If we were last, in economy or military strength, or God forbid the Olympics, right? We would do all kinds of things to change that. But we're somehow okay being close to the last in the developed world for life expectancy. Why? You know, why do we allow that? I think part of it is we blame people. You know, we are a country that honors individuality. And we want people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and honor that rugged individualism. And that's important. And we need to honor that. But that only matters when people's agency has actually been honored first. And if people's basic human needs aren't being met, they are born into social circumstances that are beyond their control, and they don't have access to resources and healthy choices, then they can't have that rugged individualism that matters. People only have the ability to make choices from options available to them. You know, there's a lot of people that don't have access to healthy food, to transportation, to a livable wage, to humane housing, to lifelong learning, civic muscle and belonging. These vital community conditions do not exist for everyone in America equally.
I like how you phrased that. And your way of thinking allows you to see problems in ways that most people cannot. And I'm jotting down some of the words that you're using. So life expectancy, lived experience. You mentioned at the beginning, disrespecting the individual. And I think that's a very powerful phrase, and I want to get back to that when I ask my follow-up question. This rugged individualism that you're talking about, this culture that you see among the people that you serve as a physician is a very unique culture, but you notice that there are the people you encounter in your daily life, and then there's the broader perception imposed upon them that creates what you call this disrespecting of the individual. Let's go through specific instances in the pandemic that your insight can provide significant value for. So the biggest and most obvious one currently is the vaccines. There is a significant vaccine hesitancy. And when you go on the news, whether it's a mainstream media outlet or one of these YouTube podcasters, there's always kind of putting a moralization onto a clinical decision. And I agree that it's, in a sense, disrespecting the individual who may have a certain frame of looking at the issue that's different. Can you talk a little bit about how you perceive this and how you communicate certain issues with your patients?
Oh, absolutely. It's my view that I'm nothing more than a resource to a person. I'm not in charge of them. I'm not responsible for them. Mm-hmm. Only to the extent that I'm responsible for providing them the best information that I have available right now. And that's my job, and to help them sort through what that looks like for their lives. I'm not making the choice for them, they are, but I'm helping them make the choice by having access to the information that they need, sometimes pointing out discrepancies in their motivation and their decisions. Motivational interviewing, I think, is vitally important in that process, hearing what's important to them, what motivates them, what goals they have, providing them with the information, challenging them sometimes with different information that they may not have access to, and then allowing them to make decisions along that trans-theoretical model of change, not expecting them to go from pre-contemplation to change immediately, but just kind of walking through that process. And so when it comes down to like a vaccine, for example, and I see the evidence, and I think it's overwhelming, and I understand the science behind it, and I understand it's been decades in the making, and billions of doses given, and the safety profile is strong, and that we need to protect the people around us and all of those things. I can't just immediately tell somebody that they're a bad person because they're not taking the vaccine. And I am really concerned about seeing nurses and physicians being unwilling to take care of people that are unvaccinated. I just am really shocked by that. And where does that end? Just because I disagree with somebody, does that mean I'm allowed to not take care of them? That already happened at the AIDS crisis, remember? And that was such a devastating thing that I think a lot of us are ashamed of. Now, we can't fall back into that sort of thinking. Just because we disagree with somebody doesn't mean that we don't take care of them. We still take care of them and we help them understand things. But if they make choices, they make choices. We're not responsible for their choices. We're responsible for providing them the information that they need, challenging their thinking sometimes in a respectful way, not get into fights with people, but just point out discrepancies and help them, you know, think along that process of change.
I like how you phrased that, because you mentioned being a resource, not making the choice. One of the things that I found is that when you validate people's perspectives, as I'm sure you have seen and experienced directly, it becomes more easy to have a meaningful conversation. And that's kind of what you're alluding to with motivational interviewing. And I like how you brought up the example from Florida where certain healthcare providers were praised for refusing to treat patients. I want to kind of discuss that a little bit further. But before we get to that point, I want to ask you one question that I think people would really like to hear your perspective on. Why do you feel we're not trained as healthcare providers on motivational interviewing, on certain empathy-based skills? Why are we not trained in that way to communicate with patients, as you've learned through your experiences, is the optimal way to improve patient decision-making?
Yeah, I think the data is overwhelmingly clear, and it does seem that the students and residents today are getting some of that my generation missed. When I was being trained, we were just coming out of that paternalistic view of medicine, you know, father knows best, you do what I say. And even doctors, you know, getting mad at patients and yelling at them and discharging them because they didn't follow their directions and all of that. That doesn't work. Right. We know that. Studies are really clear on that. And I do think that today's training is better with that, but it does still seem to be so skewed towards the science of medicine that we miss the art of medicine. There is an art to medicine, and art digs down into the humanness. Mm-hmm. We all have a shared experience of what it is to be human. And part of that is our vulnerability, our weaknesses, wrestling against, you know, life and the idea of death and disease and all of those things. And I think that there is that overemphasis on the science, the data, because that's easy to, it's easy to get your brain around from an analytical standpoint, and it's easy to do something about. You know, I see doctors in the hospital, you know, trying to correct the potassium and the sodium and, and get the numbers of the blood pressure and all of these right, you know, get all the numbers in the right boxes. But then they miss the idea that their patient's going through a divorce and that's why they've not been eating. And just getting their numbers right isn't going to help them live a more fulfilled life with purpose and meaning. And why else are we here? We live and we die. None of our patients are going to survive. You know, if it's about keeping our patients alive, we're all going to be failures because every single person that we take care of is going to die. I think it's more about trying to help them live a more purpose-driven, fulfilled life while they're here. Of course, you know, taking care of them in a science-based way, but also not forgetting that there's a humanness, a humanity that I think we're responsible for as well.
I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because when you alluded to the art of medicine, there's a humanistic component to it, coming back from Sir William Osler to even kind of Hippocrates and other individuals, where you talk about the experience of the patient, bedside clinical care. All of that is very important that you allude to, and you bring those stories alive. And when you see something like, as I mentioned before, healthcare providers being praised for refusing to treat certain patients, what goes through your mind, and how can we elevate the voices of healthcare providers like you so that people can understand that healthcare is not just about, as you mentioned, an objectively right or wrong decision. It's about the subjectivity of the patient experience. Yes, you can correct the potassium values, but are you dealing with the underlying stress for that patient? So I know I kind of asked quite a few questions in there, but if you could kind of just tease through and let us know your thoughts, I'd really appreciate that.
Yeah. I think that the healthcare providers who are refusing to take care of the people that are unvaccinated, they must have been under a tremendous amount of stress. And I think validating that is important, that
goes both ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's important, and hear that trauma that they've been through and connect them with the resources that they need. That it's okay to not be okay. We all struggle. We all go through that common shared experience of what it is to be human. And they must, on some level, have not been validated, had the support that they need. And I think there was a moral injury that was leading to burnout and frustration. And, you know, there was a breaking point. So I think it's important to validate that and to try to come up with resources to help those healthcare providers, because that is just not what we want. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is not the system that we want. Nobody, I don't think, wants that. When a healthcare provider can choose who they take care of and who they don't, something terrible is wrong. And yeah, you can just write off the people that are making those decisions, or you can listen to them, just like we should listen to the people that are not getting the vaccine, and understand their experience better, so that we can, you know, work through that system and make the system better, so everybody benefits, healthcare providers as well as the patient experience.
One of the things you allude to in your book, and kind of piggybacking off of the moral injury that you alluded to in the systems, is the influence of politics. And you make a clear distinction between the social issues, the medical issues. You tease that out. You talk about the different perspectives and how looking at both provide a more comprehensive care. But you also seem to indicate that there are gradients from the political world that could be making it more difficult for the physician, for the healthcare provider in general, and for the patients. How much of this politicization do you think is hurting healthcare, and in what ways can we address that?
I think it's hurting healthcare tremendously. There seems to be a moralization to certain diseases and a moralization to, you know, certain ways of taking care of people too. And you know, people are allowed to have their belief systems, but that has to be left at the exam room door. We are not sitting in exam rooms to moralize and tell people if they're a good or a bad person. Mm-hmm. That's not our jobs as healthcare providers. Our jobs are to help them be healthy, prosperous, have well-being. And for some reason, politics has entered into the exam room to the point where, you know, depending on where your political ideology falls, you might be making certain decisions for patients that you may not be making otherwise, or the policies being passed down are affecting how you're able to even take care of patients. My patient population is predominantly poor, a lot of Medicaid. And there's just certain procedures and medications and treatments that my patients don't have access to, that I feel like they should have access to, because they're just as valuable of a person as anyone else. And when healthcare becomes moralized and politicized, people get harmed. And in the process of people getting harmed, families get harmed, communities get harmed, and the entire nation at large ends up getting harmed. The Surgeon General signed a report called Community Health and Economic Prosperity. And the purpose of the report was to show that economic prosperity depends on community health. And unless a community has good health for every single person in it, there's always going to be a weight pulling the economy down. So even from an economic standpoint, we have to invest in people's health first and foremost before we do anything else.
Yeah, you mentioned that quite a few times, and you correlate that through the stories of the people, the economic prosperity and the community health. You're also now starting to see a lot of data, clinical literature out quantifying economic prosperity relative to certain patient outcomes, be it employment rate relative to substance use dependency overdoses. What do you see positively about that trend in clinical medicine? And what do you see needs to be further studied and further examined that you feel isn't being evaluated as much?
There's still a stigma on certain diseases. You know, if you're obese, if you have chronic pain, if you have substance use disorder, if you have HIV, there's still a stigma there that keeps you know, people at an arm's distance. Mm-hmm. And that goes for healthcare. It goes for job training and school access to education and all of that. And so I think as that data comes out, I think looking at ways to overcome that stigma, helping to educate communities, business leaders, schools, healthcare providers about the need to not stigmatize people, that diseases need to be treated, not moralized. Yeah. And in the process, harming. So I would love to see ways to, you know, there's my residency director would teach us the difference between what he called DOEs and POEMS. Mm-hmm. DOEs are data oriented evidence, and POEMS are patient oriented evidence that matters. So you can have, you know, some DOEs that shows you the data on certain numbers and statistics and all of that kind of stuff, or you can have POEMS that start showing you patient-oriented evidence that matters, where you have endpoints that really impact a person's life. And I think figuring out ways to change perceptions, biases, the way people stigmatize other people, educational tools, those sorts of things. If we can find tools that work in a real way, a real-world way that decreases that bias and stigma against other people, I think that's going to probably be the most revolutionary thing that we can do in modern medicine. That's a big statement, but I think that might be true.
I would tend to agree with you, because as we start to get more technology oriented, it's now the perceptions of patient care from the provider and patient standpoint that'll really be the limiting step. So I don't think that's that's a strong statement at all. I think that's a very astute statement. Now, I want to be respectful of your time, but I do want to ask two questions before we go. And I really enjoyed speaking with you. It was a great experience.
You too.
So thank
Absolutely,
you.
Yeah.
The first question is, as an author, getting your book out there and having it received so positively by so many different people, what is the one moment where you felt, wow, I'm really doing something positive with this book?
I guess when I was asked to testify before the U.S. Senate.
Wow.
And when I have Bernie Sanders and Senator Collins, you know, addressing me and asking me questions and listening to my experiences, working with real people that they represent and trying to understand why there are health disparities in the United States. When I had that opportunity in July, I think that was one of the big moments that, yeah, this has the potential to help change things. I titled it Canary in the Coal Mine, because, you know, it alludes to how coal miners brought canaries into the coal mines with them to warn them of toxic conditions that exist. And if there's toxic conditions, you need to make a change or people are going to be harmed. And there are toxic conditions in America that are harming people. And so, you know, Scott County, what happened there got in the international news. And so, you know, to me, that's the canary in the coal mine. There are toxic conditions that exist in America that's decreasing our life expectancy, that's causing more harm to people. And we have the opportunity to take notice and to change things so that people are no longer harmed and are able to live longer, healthier, more productive lives so that we all benefit in the end.
That's very true. Now, one last question before we conclude. As an author with a very impactful book that is very timely, prescient in many ways, people are naturally gravitated and influenced by you. There's always going to be those wow moments when people come across you. But I want to kind of switch it a little bit. When was your wow moment? I know testifying in front of Congress is a pretty big deal, but when was it almost one of those kind of wow moments that you experienced in this whole process?
From writing the book or working with people in my community?
Probably,
or even.
I would say either or. I guess, yeah, I didn't phrase that properly, but I'm saying kind of writing the book and then in the process of it, being engaged with community, maybe outside of your typical patient base.
Well, you know, the book was, I started my practice in 2004. And actually, even before then, going through medical school and my family and all of that. So it was my whole life, you know, that really informed the book and led into the book. And then the actual writing of the book, you know, was several years on top of my, you know, day job of taking care of patients and taking care of my family. I'm also writing a book on the side. And so it took several years and editing process. And so there was a lot of me that went into it. And so when I got the book in the mail and I was able to hold it in my hands and see it. You know, the only thing I can compare it to is when my kids were born and I got to hold them, you know, in my hands. It wasn't quite that amazing, but it was pretty close. You know, this is a labor of love and a lot of heartache, a lot of years of going through depression and difficulties and just working with communities and then working to write it, to actually hold it in my hand, that would be definitely a wow moment. As far as patients go, I used to deliver babies.
Okay.
And in 2018, our critical access hospital suffered, you know, a blow as similar, you know, critical access hospitals across America have when we lost our obstetrics department. And so I wasn't able to deliver babies at our hospital anymore. And it was always a joyful moment when it went well to be able to tell a patient, you know, it's a boy, it's a girl, you know, here's your baby, instead of it's cancer, You know, that's a different thing. And it was always this really positive experience, seeing this new life and the family. And I lost that in 2018. But at that time, I was really getting more and more into addiction medicine and working with people with substance use disorder. And what I found was that that provided me the same experience. You know, I work with, you know, somebody that may have been living on the street, you know, selling their body just to get by. And then watching them slowly come back to life and, you know, get a job and start thriving in life, get their family back, reunite with relationships. And then they come in, you know, months, years later, and they're a new life. And that is such a joyful moment. It's wow, you know, I'm making a difference. It's really great to see that. So I would say anytime that happens, I still experience that because I never got tired of delivering babies. Every single baby I delivered was this just beautiful, wonderful moment. And every time I see one of my patients that come in who, you know, had been struggling with substance use disorder and now they've got their life back, it's that same experience.
Wow. It's the birth and rebirth. I really like how you phrased that. Thank you, sir. Let me just quickly mention the title again and all of that before we conclude. So again, we have had an amazing conversation with Dr. William Cook, author of Canary in the Coal Mine, A Forgotten Rural Community, A Hidden Epidemic, and A Lone Doctor Battling for the Life, Health, and Soul of the People. It's one doctor's courageous fight to save a small town from a silent epidemic that threatened the community's future and expose a national health crisis. So Dr. Cook, congratulations on the book. Extremely well-written, extremely poignant, and it was great speaking with you.
Absolutely, I enjoyed the conversation too. And I hope we're able to talk more and maybe even get together in person one of these days when the pandemic's over or something.
Yeah, no, that would be great. I'd like that.
Great.
Take care, sir. Have a good day.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.